Have you ever wondered why a simple indulgence, be it a cigarette, a slice of cake, or even a day off, can trigger such intense feelings of guilt? In our modern society, wellness has transformed from a personal choice into a moral imperative. This shift forms the foundation of what Carl Cederstrom and Andre Spicer identify as the wellness syndrome, a cultural phenomenon where health and happiness have become not just goals, but moral obligations. The book has sparked conversations among celebrities like Gwyneth Paltrow, whose Goop empire embodies many of the contradictions explored within its pages, and has been cited in discussions about the $4.5 trillion global wellness industry. As mental health advocates like Brené Brown have noted, our obsession with perfecting our bodies and minds often leads to the very anxiety and unhappiness we're trying to avoid. The wellness syndrome doesn't just describe a cultural trend. It diagnoses a profound shift in how we understand what it means to be good, successful, and worthy in contemporary society. Today's university students increasingly sign wellness contracts promoting substance-free living and holistic approaches to health. These contracts often include pledges to maintain regular sleep schedules, practice mindfulness, attend wellness seminars, and participate in fitness programs. What was once considered essential to the college experience, experimentation and transformation, has been sanitized in favor of wellness as a moral imperative. This trend extends beyond campuses into every corner of society, from corporate wellness programs to prison rehabilitation initiatives that emphasize meditation and yoga. Even elementary schools now incorporate wellness hours and mindfulness practices into their daily routines. The wellness ideology has fundamentally altered how we view those who fail to maintain their bodies. Smokers and overweight people are seen not merely as unhealthy, but as moral failures threatening society's well-being. Publix ACEs increasingly restrict smoking, while employers implement health screening programs that penalize those who don't meet specific wellness metrics. Social media amplifies this judgment, with before and after transformations celebrated as evidence of moral virtue. This transformation represents what philosopher Alenka Zupancic calls biomorality, a system where feeling good equals being good, while feeling bad makes one morally suspect. The result is what Slavoj Žižek terms the superego injunction to enjoy, a paradoxical command that generates anxiety rather than pleasure. When we fail to achieve the mandated state of wellness, we blame ourselves rather than external circumstances. This self-blame manifests in countless ways: guilt over skipped workouts, anxiety about food choices, and shame over not achieving optimal sleep patterns. The wellness syndrome creates a peculiar relationship with our bodies, transforming everything into either threat or remedy. Eating ceases to be pleasurable and instead becomes a paranoid performance of nutritional optimization. Each meal becomes an opportunity for virtue signaling or self-reproach. Dietitians and celebrity chefs ascend to priestly status, offering salvation through nutrition plans and clean recipes. Social media influencers become wellness prophets, their morning routines and supplement regimens followed with religious devotion. This obsession combines bodily fixation with a quest for authenticity, where self-improvement becomes moral responsibility. The end result is what philosopher Simon Critchley calls passive nihilism, a withdrawal into self-perfection rather than engagement with broader social problems. Instead of addressing systemic issues like healthcare inequality or environmental degradation, we retreat into personal wellness projects, treating bodily signals as substitutes for universal truth. The wellness syndrome doesn't just change how we eat or exercise, it fundamentally alters how we understand our place in the world and our responsibilities to others. This shift manifests in the rise of wellness tourism, boutique fitness studios, and expensive organic markets that serve as temples of self-optimization, while excluding those who can't afford entry into this moral economy. The tragic story of Lynn Rosen and John Liddick, happiness-preaching life coaches who committed suicide together in their Park Slope apartment, starkly reveals the dark underbelly of the wellness industry. Their radio show, The Pursuit of Happiness, embodied the self-help industry's vague yet insistent commands: be happy, nurture your body, cultivate positivity, manifest abundance. This now $2 billion industry, employing over 45,000 coaches worldwide, creates a paradoxical trap. We increasingly outsource our most intimate life decisions to experts while simultaneously bearing total responsibility for our well-being. The industry's explosive growth reflects both rising anxiety and the commodification of happiness itself. Television advertisements and social media influencers perfectly capture the contradictory ideal human of contemporary capitalism, the man of now and the woman of now. These aspirational figures must somehow embody opposing virtues: be free-spirited yet rigorously disciplined, environmentally conscious yet enthusiastically consumption-oriented, and perpetually connected while maintaining authentic presence. They practice mindfulness between meetings, eat organic fast food, and maintain work-life balance while being available 24/7. This hyper-individualized figure can be communist capitalist, feminist misogynist, queer homophobe, simultaneously without acknowledging painful trade-offs or inherent contradictions. This new ideal contrasts sharply with the conformist organizational men and women of mid-20th century corporate culture who simply needed to fit in and follow rules. Google's most popular training program, Search Inside Yourself, exemplifies how ancient practices like mindfulness have been repurposed to optimize workers rather than provide genuine spiritual insight. The program promises increased productivity, emotional intelligence, and stress reduction through meditation. What distinguishes contemporary mindfulness is its peculiar packaging, a hybrid of Eastern spirituality, self-help psychology, neuroscience, and business jargon, claiming scientific legitimacy despite limited evidence. Programs like these, now standard at major corporations from Goldman Sachs to General Mills, conveniently shift responsibility for workplace stress onto individuals rather than addressing toxic environments, treating stress as a personal deficiency requiring self-improvement rather than a product of systemic conditions. The moral transformation of smoking over recent decades illustrates this shift perfectly. What began as medical knowledge about health risks has morphed into comprehensive moral judgment. Smoking is bad for health becomes smokers are bad, irresponsible people. This moralization process is central to the wellness syndrome, where health becomes the fundamental criterion for moral worth and social status. The responsibility for health shifts dramatically from medical authorities and social institutions to individuals, making illness a personal moral failure rather than a natural occurrence or social problem. Politics becomes increasingly privatized and moralized, with lifestyle choices and consumption patterns replacing public deliberation about the common good. From organic food to fitness tracking, personal health choices now carry intense moral weight, creating new hierarchies of virtue based on wellness practices. Investment bankers working 120-hour weeks reveal our culture's dysfunctional relationship with the body. Initially, they try to overcome bodily limitations, treating their flesh as an enemy to productivity. By year four, their bodies fight back with rage episodes and injuries until survivors learn to treat their bodies as trusted friends. This pattern extends beyond finance into medicine, law, and even routine service jobs where workers deny basic needs like sleep. The corporate world has responded by reframing executives as corporate athletes who need training regimes to achieve ideal performance states. Over half of large U.S. employers now offer wellness programs, spending $6 billion annually on initiatives from diet counseling to on-site gyms. These programs blur work-leisure boundaries with innovations like walking meetings, treadmill desks, and bicycle workstations. At Swedish truck manufacturer Scania, the 24-hour employee concept extends corporate control beyond working hours under the guise of care. Their extensive wellness apparatus includes fitness facilities, lunch walks, and invasive health talks, where employees answer questions about eating habits, exercise routines, and even loneliness. Many employees embrace these programs as unemployment insurance. Staying fit makes them attractive to employers during uncertain times. The Protestant work ethic has been replaced by the workout ethic, where exercising has become the price of entry to continued employment. diet and culture intertwines guilt with pleasure in complex ways. Many dieters, like Kate Harrison, seek relief from guilt through regimens like the 5-2 diet, hoping that fasting will free them from the comfort eating and guilt cycle. However, as Zygmunt Bauman observes, dieting often intensifies rather than alleviates guilt. Studies confirm this paradox. 33% of dietary program participants report feeling more guilty afterward, with dieters experiencing higher guilt levels than the general population. The wellness syndrome has found its perfect foil in the figure of the chav, a derogatory British term for working-class people portrayed as undisciplined, unhealthy, and morally deficient. Reality television shows routinely depict working-class women as beyond governance, excessively loud, drunk, and having lost control over their bodies. The proliferation of fat programs ostensibly offer dietary interventions, but actually serve to expose working-class families, especially mothers, as incapable of knowing how to look after themselves. These representations provide middle-class viewers with a spectacle of subjectivity turned sour and an epidemic of the will. Jamie Oliver's transformation of food into a moral intervention designed to correct social and personal ills pioneered the now widespread belief that eating well makes you morally good, even against your will. His groundbreaking show, Jamie's School Dinners, exemplified this approach by attempting to reform children in a deprived school by changing their canteen food, replacing turkey Twizzlers with vegetable bakes. Despite resistance from cafeteria staff, children, and parents, Oliver persevered, eventually mobilizing 250,000 citizens to petition for better school food. This led to concrete policy changes. Certain foods were banned, and the government established a £60 million school food trust. Oliver continued his food revolution in follow-up shows, confronting resistance in places like Rotherham, the UK's obesity capital. After meeting a single mother with a fridge full of junk food, he despaired. "I've been to Soweto, and I've seen AIDS orphans eating better than this." What's striking about Oliver's crusade isn't just his establishment of a biomoral panopticon where dietary failures are broadcast to millions, but the audacious assumption that serious social policy issues can be addressed through dietary intervention. The fate of disadvantaged children is framed not as determined by education policy, class structures, unemployment, or capitalism, but by what they eat. The turkey Twizzler becomes disgusting not merely for its content, but because it symbolizes all forms of discrimination and injustice visited upon these children. This approach resonates because it suggests political interventions are only acceptable when they avoid broader issues and focus on narrow behavioral changes. Questions about government services, industry policy, or class systems are replaced by menu changes and cooking classes. This allows middle-class activists to feel they've done something worthy while leaving more fundamental political issues untouched, the essence of biomorality, providing a sense of smug righteousness while believing that if only everyone were more like you, the world would be both happier and healthier. Martin Seligman, the self-proclaimed high priest of positive psychology, rejects Freudian modesty and the goal of merely turning hysterical misery into common unhappiness. Instead, he advocates moving from +2 to +7 in your life, viewing happiness as something that can be amplified like a hi-fi system if you simply put your mind to it. Positive psychology has deeper historical roots in American culture. Barbara Ehrenreich traces it back to Calvinism, a religion emphasizing self-examination that she describes as socially imposed depression. As American conditions improved in the mid-1800s, the New Thought movement emerged, presenting humans as divine creatures with infinitely powerful minds. This movement preserved Calvinism's judgmentalism while adding magical thinking, combining the belief that you can achieve anything with a positive attitude alongside harsh personal responsibility. If you fail, it's your fault. Norman Vincent Peale's 1952 bestseller, The Power of Positive Thinking, brought these ideas to the masses, particularly appealing to struggling salesmen needing confidence boosts. While Seligman distances himself from Peale's cheap approach, claiming his own method is scientifically based, both share the fundamental belief that happiness and success is ultimately an individual choice. When journalist Barbara Ehrenreich questioned the scientific basis of Seligman's work, particularly his happiness equation, H equals S plus C plus V, she found him evasive. When pressed about the units of measurement, Seligman reluctantly admitted that components like C would decompose into 20 different things, like religion and marriage, revealing the shaky empirical foundation of his supposedly scientific approach. Despite these weaknesses, positive psychology has successfully established itself as a legitimate academic discipline, attracting funding, entering university curriculums, and spawning its own Journal of Happiness Studies. Business schools have been particularly receptive, using happiness studies to legitimize management practices. The fundamental assumption that happiness causes productivity rather than vice versa drives business-oriented happiness research, despite methodological flaws like self-reporting, demonstrated when finding a planted dime significantly affected subjects' reported life satisfaction. British Prime Minister David Cameron's 2010 announcement of plans to measure national well-being came during a time of student protests, union mobilization against austerity, and economic recession. Cameron framed the happiness initiative not as contradicting his economic priorities, but complementing them. "I am absolutely clear that our most urgent priority is to get the economy moving. We're trying to make it easier for people to start their own business, we're cutting corporate tax, we're getting behind entrepreneurs." This aligned perfectly with positive psychology's message that external circumstances matter little for happiness, a convenient position when implementing austerity measures. Rather than merely distracting from austerity, Cameron's happiness initiative represented a fundamental reframing of government, positioning happiness as an attitude that empowers people to change their own situations without government support. In this framework, cutting benefits becomes not punishment, but motivation to transform passive, overweight blobs into resilient entrepreneurs. The fundamental question of how we know we're happy proves elusive in both academic and everyday contexts. Our standard greeting, "How's it going?" forces the respondent to quickly assemble a coherent self-narrative that often has little to do with their actual experience. Alenka Zupancic brilliantly identifies the question's inherent tension between two subjects: the it, one's external life circumstances, and the unspoken I, one's internal state. The standard response, "Very well, thank you," maintains this ambiguity while potentially masking the truth. "It is going very well, but me, well, that's another matter." This tension manifests in what Bourdieu calls petite bourgeois suffering, middle-class families trapped in good life fantasies, as Lauren Berlant terms them, that have become increasingly unachievable. They pursue Project It through perfect houses, suburbs, and lifestyles, only to find themselves locked in impossible constraints, isolated and exhausted. Modern society has undergone a profound shift from prohibition to mandatory enjoyment. Where traditional society required suppressing desires to fit in, we now face a moral imperative to express desires and pursue happiness without delay. As Pascal Bruckner observes, we're expected to be happy 24/7, not just during designated leisure hours. When Chris Dancy lost his job in 2009, he didn't pursue traditional job hunting tactics, but instead embraced extreme self-tracking. "If you can measure it, someone will, and that somebody should be you," he explains. Using multiple bodily sensors to monitor everything from pulse to REM sleep to toilet habits, Dancy exemplifies the quantified self movement that promises self-knowledge through numbers. This isn't Socrates' philosophical self-examination, but a market-driven reconfiguration of the self as product. The quantified self movement has exploded with the rise of affordable wearable technologies. Enthusiasts track sleep patterns, heart rates, moods, and environmental factors, then analyze correlations and share findings at show-and-tells, where they reveal intimate details of bodily functions. This compulsion goes beyond eliminating bad habits. It's about reconfiguring the entire self as a streamlined business. One entrepreneur described his life logging as running a startup, constantly analyzing performance metrics. This perfectly embodies what Philip Mirovsky calls the ideal neoliberal agent who sees herself simultaneously as employee, product, advertisement, manager, biographer, and entrepreneur. Corporate interests have embraced these technologies, with hedge fund GLG partners tracking traders' sleep and diet patterns, then offering coaching to improve bodily routines. The Chicago Teachers Union was forced to accept a contract requiring members to share biometric information and wellness activities or face a $600 penalty. This represents what Gilles Deleuze called societies of control, where boundaries between work and life dissolve completely, and surveillance becomes omnipresent yet seductively packaged as personal empowerment. A growing genre of games aims not to provide escape, but to make people more effective and productive in all areas of life. Gamification applies game logic to real-world situations, transforming boring activities through rewards, badges, points, or money that incentivize continued and improved performance. For those wanting to gamify their entire existence, Epic Win turns everyday tasks into quests where your avatar earns rewards for completing laundry or answering emails. This approach revives B.F. Skinner's behavioral psychology, which found that organisms respond to rewards and reinforced behaviors persist over time. The paradox deepens as self-trackers willingly submit to authoritarian techniques while violently protesting government data collection. Their Orwellian fears focus exclusively on governments while ignoring corporations like Google, Facebook, and Axiom that collect vast amounts of personal data. Illness, surprisingly, can bring unexpected pleasure. In Karl Ove Knausgård's autobiographical novel My Struggle, he describes breaking his collarbone during football and experiencing an unlikely enjoyment upon returning home. After eating, I lay down on the sofa with a cushion behind my back, watching an Italian football match on TV. This simple act was extraordinary. In 4 years of having children, he'd only experienced such leisure once before when severely ill. Web developer Rob Lucas expresses a similar sentiment about illness providing respite from work's constant demands. He writes that, "It is only when sickness comes and I am involuntarily rendered incapable of work that I really regain any extra time for myself." For Lucas, illness isn't merely pathological, but almost willed, a holiday that the body demands for itself. The fat acceptance movement frames fatness as a civil rights issue, comparing weight discrimination to other forms of prejudice. They've successfully campaigned against discriminatory billboards and supported legal protections. However, their conferences often focus on lifestyle issues like water aerobics, self-love, and sexuality. Paradoxically, fat acceptance advocates often emphasize other wellness values, being socially outgoing, hardworking, and adventurous, while rejecting only the slim body ideal. Barebacking, gay men having sex without condoms, directly challenges wellness ethics through unsafe sex. Tim Dean's book, Unlimited Intimacy, explores this subculture, explaining it's an activity deeply invested with meaning. The community divides into bug chasers who seek HIV infection, viewing it as a gift, and gift givers who knowingly transmit the virus. This practice emerged partly as a reaction to the AIDS epidemic, which prompted efforts to rehabilitate gay men's image through promoting sexual responsibility and safe sex. What makes this subculture particularly significant is its deliberate rejection of wellness ideology. It questions the image of the well-maintained body as potentially immortal and expresses skepticism regarding ideals of health and risk avoidance. Unlike fat acceptance advocates who embrace most wellness values while rejecting only one aspect, barebackers resolutely reject the health imperative entirely, inverting wellness demands in a way that shocks prevailing moral norms. In contrast to the managed pleasures of wellness culture, Zadie Smith's essay Joy explores the rare, uncontrollable emotion that presupposes surprise and elation. Smith describes joy as a disruptive force that shakes us brutally, an emotion so intense she's experienced it only 5 or 6 times in her life. Unlike pleasure, which we carefully regulate like diabetics monitoring sugar levels, joy cannot be measured or optimized. This distinction becomes crucial in understanding how modern society has conflated momentary happiness with profound joy, attempting to package and sell transcendent experiences as consumable products. Smith vividly recalls a transformative night at London's Fabric Club, dancing on ecstasy with a rail-thin stranger she calls Smiley. "We gave ourselves over to joy," she writes, distinguishing this overwhelming experience from mere pleasure. "A beach holiday is pleasure, but on that dance floor, I was joy. The impermanence of this moment gives it meaning. Unlike replaceable everyday pleasures, joy arrives unexpectedly and cannot be replicated. The raw authenticity of this experience stands in stark contrast to today's curated moments of peak experiences that flood social media feeds and wellness retreats. 2 decades later, nearby club Morning Glory represents wellness culture's sanitized alternative. No drugs, no alcohol, just early morning dancing for city workers before heading to the office. It's like clubbing, but instead of crawling out into the darkness afterwards feeling horrible, you go to work feeling great, an organizer explains. This club epitomizes the modern marriage of pleasure with productivity, a place for the fun-loving, extroverted individual who loves to work and party, especially when the two are combined. The commodification of experience has reached its logical conclusion. Even rebellion must now serve the bottom line. Finding escape from the wellness syndrome requires stopping our obsessive bodily self-monitoring, abandoning fixations with health and happiness, and rejecting the illusion of limitless human potential. We must recognize that as humans, we're defined not just by our potential, but by our impotence, our inevitable failures and limitations. What makes life worthwhile is often the pain it entails. Truth brings misery, political action involved danger, beauty contains sorrow, and love tears us apart. The pursuit of pure pleasure leads to a sanitized existence that paradoxically drains life of its vital essence. The wellness industry's promise of perpetual optimization ignores fundamental human truths, that growth often comes through struggle, that meaningful connections arise from shared vulnerability, and that joy's rarity makes it precious. Choosing only pleasure might minimize unwellness, but it leads to isolation and a diminished experience of life's full spectrum. Instead of dwelling on our own sickness, we should address the sickness of the world, engaging with life's complexities rather than retreating into the false security of wellness culture's promises.